Welcome to a new episode of Computationally Yours. We are your hosts. I'm Dr. Sabah Kadri.
And I am Arshi Arora. This is Computationally Yours.
10 episodes ago, we were very excited to host our 10th episode. Today, we are equally happy to record the 20th episode.
Yes, truly, Sabah. And thanks to our listeners who are supporting us and continuing to listen to us all this time. We are actually increasing our following every week. And we've actually formed a special bond recording this podcast, putting what we love out there.
Yes, we have to say thank you so much to our listeners. We're almost forming a tradition here, don't you think, Arshi? Episode 1 and 10, we shared a little bit about ourselves and our journeys into science. So I was thinking that keeping up with that, today in episode 20, we should share our professional stories, you know, some themes and lessons that we've learned along the way. And I really hope that for the budding scientists out there, and especially for women in science, maybe you can learn something from our stories, or if nothing else, at least get entertained by them. For example, I have been in the field of computational biology for 14 years now and working in the clinical space for 6+ years. I have so many stories to tell.
And we're just getting started with that. I've been in the field for 10 years. And I think, Sabah, you bring a unique perspective to each of our stories. I hold 2 masters and you hold a doctorate degree. So let's start with the first question, which is to you. We both started with the same master's program in Carnegie Mellon, which was the computational biology program. But you decided to switch to the PhD program, I think, in your second year.
Mm-hmm.
So what prompted you for that switch? And how did you know that you wanted to do your PhD? Some do their PhD after a few years of their job experience. So tell us more about this decision of yours.
This was not a very complicated decision for me at all. I came to the United States for my master's right after undergrad in India. And while I was still dealing with the culture shock of moving to a new country, I also wanted to make the most of my opportunity. You know, I came from a humble household, came here with a student loan like most students do. And I think Carnegie Mellon just kind of took my breath away. In my first 2 months of classes, I knew that I had found the field that I wanted to be in for the rest of my life. But then the decision was, you know, as you said, whether I continue with my master's, pay off my loan, pursue my PhD later after some job experience, or should I just do the deep dive immediately? So at that point, the decision seemed fairly simple. I didn't want to have a break in my studies, so I did apply for the PhD program. I also interviewed for it and I got in after my first year of master's. In fact, last year, actually, I went back for the 10-year anniversary of our computational biology department. And I'm not kidding. While listening to my professors from grad school talk there, I felt the same butterflies in my stomach. I know it sounds a little cheesy, but I really did. The only thing that I would say to students who are trying to pursue their PhD is that it is definitely a big commitment. We used to joke in our program that it's like a contractual marriage for like 4 to 6 years. So you must really love what you do to stick it out, you know, on the days that it is not easy and sometimes it isn't. So I was lucky. I mean, I did my PhD in 4.5 years, but I definitely had a lot of hard days. Actually, it was more like 2 years of hard days.
True feelings, I think. True feelings. Sabah, that's quite understandable. And I think the word PhD by itself is definitely reflective of all the hard work and sweat one puts in. But, you know, on the other hand, I was also wondering how much we use the word PhD in the colloquial sense. It's kind of overused in some sense. For example, I know when I was doing research for my wedding, I literally said to my mom that, you know, mom, I did an entire PhD on bridal outfits.
It's actually true. People tend to use that quite a bit. So Arshi, tell me a little bit more about your decision to pursue your master's. I know that you had a very different decision journey than me.
That's right. Happy to share that story, Sabah. So after undergrad, I think fields such as bioinformatics, genomics, computational biology, they were still very new words. I think I had trouble explaining it to my mom, really, because it was very different from traditional fields like physics, chemistry, or maths. And when I entered this field, unlike you, I did not know off the bat what I should really do in this. And I think we didn't even know what this field had to offer. But I knew this much, that I broadly wanted to stick to some scientific field. But then again, you know, like all children, I also wanted to be an astronaut. Haha, big surprise. Anyway, so I got an admit to Carnegie Mellon. And it was at Carnegie Mellon where I was just blown away by the research. And more importantly, people's passion. And I wonder, do I have it in me? You know, I still ask that sometime. And I guess that's the process of growing and evolving.
Well said, Arshi.
Yeah. So anyways, I did my master's, which was quite heavy on the bank, but I was mostly trained in programming. And maybe I took a few courses in statistics here and there. But 10 years ago, the field of data science was at the cusp of blowing up. I wish I knew that today statistics would be so much in demand and so applicable. I had taken more courses. But coming back to the programming experience in my journey, Saba, do you remember how we used to align the sequences ourselves? And especially, you know, when we had those adapters, we used to trim them ourselves. We used to even align mouse sequencing ourselves. I'm wondering if you remember that bit.
Oh my God, yeah. The concept of automation and just in general, software engineering and programming came a little bit slow in bioinformatics, I think. But even going back to our training, Arshi, I remember a Computational Biology 101, we learned about dynamic programming and just taking two sequences and doing BLAST manually. That was a lot of fun too.
I remember that. Yeah.
So, you know, here's when I want to take a second and I'd like to preach to our audience about the importance of fundamentals in your training. I think it is really easy to get swayed by all these latest technologies and automation, but I strongly believe training must be about these fundamentals and about really getting your hands dirty and doing some of this manual work. Anyway, so I digress. Arshi, I want to know what happened next in your story.
Yes. So now in 2012, I got hired as an assistant research biostatistician at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And then again, I was just washed by how my mentors, who are experts in their field, just what amazing research and how passionate they are about their field. I was also exposed to a very healthy collaborative atmosphere. Now, at this point, since I'm at Department of Biostatistics, I really wanted to address some gaps in my knowledge. And there was a lot of self-teaching involved. But maybe I felt I quite didn't fit in. So guess what? I decided to do another master's. And at the same time, there was still an option to do a doctorate degree. But if I'm really honest here, A, I wasn't really sure how much statistics I could grasp from there on. And to be honest, just the burden of the title PhD was a little overwhelming.
I can completely understand that. And like I've told you before, I personally think it is very brave of you to go back to school, especially with a full-time job.
Oh, I agree. It was difficult in the beginning, but I think I am reaping benefits and fruits of that master's degree. So I'm glad actually I did it. But if you see here, there's a pattern. And imagine a curve, you know, when you want to know something, you climb that curve and you feel pretty good about getting to the top. In the sense that when you finally know whatever you want to know and you get to the top, you start working on new projects. But finally, when you start working on the new projects, you kind of realize some more gaps in your knowledge. And then again, that curve starts to go down and then it again comes up when you start to pick up something else. So what I'm really trying to say is that there is always this ups and downs where you have to fill your knowledge in the gap. And there's a lot of self-teaching involved.
Wow, Arshi, I like that analogy of the curve. That's interesting. That's the first time I've heard that.
Anyways, so Saba, let's talk a little more about yourself and your PhD. Something that's really unique about your computational biology PhD is that you did wet lab experiments as well, side by side. What exactly prompted you to take up that decision?
Oh, yeah, that was the best decision I made for my grad school. So, in my first year, when I was doing my master's, I took a course in molecular biology. It was quite an advanced course. But because I came from a computer engineering background and the last time I'd done biology was in high school, I really wanted to take a strong biology course. I also strongly believe that a good computational biologist requires a deep understanding of biology and biological processes in general. Otherwise, you tend to run the risk of being superficial in your training. So I had two advisors during my PhD. One advisor, Dr. Veronica Hinman, who advised me on the experimental side of things, and my other advisor, Dr. Takis Benos, who was my computational advisor. Dr. Benos is actually how Arshi and I met. She was working in this lab when I was a PhD student there.
Actually, yes. You know, all my interest in genomics goes to Baino's lab. My time spent there had a huge influence over the next few important decisions in my life.
I share that with you, Arshi, definitely. Anyway, so coming back to your question about how I ended up doing experiments in my PhD. So during this entire molecular biology course, I realized that I had a lot to learn. So when my final semester paper was up, I wrote about this project idea I had for studying microRNAs. For those who might not know, microRNAs are these small non-coding genes, which we definitely don't have enough time to explain right now. But they're these small non-coding genes, and I was very mesmerized by them. In my second semester, I ended up joining Dr. Hinman's group as a volunteer research assistant in order to just dip my toes in experiments. And I really loved what I did with her. I happened to show her the semester paper I had written for my molecular biology course. The timing of all of this was quite serendipitous because I was also interviewing for my PhD at the same time. So a lot was happening. So Dr. Hinman basically told me that if I did get into the PhD program, that I could join her lab and convert my semester paper into a PhD thesis as long as I found a computational co-advisor. And that's exactly what happened. I met Dr. DeBenos during my interview process. We had amazing conversations over dinner. I asked him if he would be my co-advisor after I got in. The rest was history. That's how I decided that I wanted to do both things. And trust me, I think I'm a better scientist just because I worked on both sides of things.
Wow, Sabah, I think that really came directly from your heart. I've never heard you tell this story before to me. So I really liked it. But then again, tell me, what made you drop the experimental side of your work in your jobs?
Oh, I mean, I think I realized during my PhD that I'm not an experimental biologist at my core. At my core, I'm still a computational person, and I'm a better one because I did those experiments, but maybe not something that I would go through during my job. But Arshi, I have a vague recollection that you did some experimental work during your undergraduate or something. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, you're actually right. I think I dipped my toes as well in experimental biology, wearing a lab coat and running some experiments. But that was very for a very brief period of my life. So I think I interned at a pharma company, helping with just the drug quality control work, and then later on at water recycling plant, again checking for quality control for water batches. You know, that seems like ages ago. Anyway, Sabah, do you remember the first computational biology software that you wrote?
Oh my God, of course. I could never forget that. And I can never forget the feeling I had when my first author paper released, and which was on the software that I had written.
That is really exciting. What was it called? Wasn't it something like HMIR? How do you pronounce it?
Oh, it was HHMMIR. I used to call it Hamir, but I mean, it's definitely not easy on the tongue, definitely has no vowels except for that last I. Anyway, so HHMMIR actually stands for Hierarchical Hidden Markov Model for microRNAs. In short, it was a machine learning method that I built to classify parts of the genome that have the potential to contain those microRNA genes that I was talking about earlier. It's basically a complex type of hidden Markov model, which just has an additional dimension to it. The model itself, actually, for those who might be interested, is very commonly used in speech and handwriting recognition. I basically adapted it for this particular biological application, something that computational biology is kind of all about, right? I wrote this really complex software in Java, and I'm sure if I ever read my code again, I haven't done that in a few years now, I would really criticize my programming at that point. But yeah, it was such an amazing feeling to write that. It was a lot of sleepless nights as well. But speaking of first author software papers, Arshi, I think congratulations are due. You recently published Surfclast. You should tell our listeners about it.
Yes, happy to. It is, again, like a very proud and an emotional moment for me as well. So Surfclast is a supervised clustering algorithm. It clusters your molecular data, keeping the survival outcome in mind. So the first thing that we do when we get sequencing data or any molecular data is to perform an unsupervised clustering and then identify different groups in it, and then finally go ahead and line it up with, if you have survival data, and see whether it links to any survival differentiation. What I am proposing is that how about we inbuilt the survival information along with the molecular data and kind of have these clean clusters that will kind of delineate the survival risk groups in your cohort if you have any. So I'm really interested in this supervised learning approach where we know what we are looking for, and it gives the users the flexibility to pick the outcome of interest and get the resulting outcome.
Arshi, I have seen the results of your software. So this is something that I can say is amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyway, Sabha, so you mentioned that you changed your focus from basic research to the clinical setting a few years ago. At what point did that change happen, and what drove that decision?
I think my first job after my PhD, I was doing basic science. I was studying mouse embryonic stem cell gene expression, and I learned a lot at my job at the Broad Institute. But when it was time to move on from that position, I felt like I would have more satisfaction finding a job where I was either studying or working in human disease, something more practical, something with an impact on health. And I saw this clinical bioinformatics position at University of Chicago. Now, at that point, clinical bioinformatics was still developing. There wasn't that much out there about it, not like how it is today. Anyway, I interviewed and I immediately knew that this is what I wanted to do next. And now I've been in clinical bioinformatics ever since. My current job is as a faculty member doing clinical bioinformatics in pediatrics now.
Oh, that's great, Sabha. I wanted to share something else about you. How was your first week of classes? How does it feel to teach on Zoom?
Ooh, it's interesting. I mean, there are people doing a lot more teaching than me. But yeah, classes started a few weeks ago. I think it's almost harder to keep the students' attention for a long period of time on a virtual platform. My class is 3 hours long.
Ouch.
It's long, but that said, I really am learning a lot from it. And doing it virtually definitely keeps you on your toes, believe it or not. I was nervous on my first class, but it got easier from there. I think the best tool to use in a virtual classroom in grad school is polling questions. It keeps people entertained.
I can imagine the challenges. Anyway, so now let's talk about sharing our work. Once you come into this field of research, there are just so many avenues in which you can participate. You write software packages, you write manuscripts, there are grants. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Yes, the holy trinity for a research scientist in computational biology, right? Grants, manuscripts, and software packages. Since I come from a clinical setting, I wanted to mention how in our previous episode where we asked our panel of leaders in clinical bioinformatics how they balance research and clinical work, and basically, their answer was that they don't and they can't. So I just want to reiterate that, you know, it gets really hard to apply for grants, write manuscripts. And the only way to do that with a very demanding clinical job is by just working extra hours every day. And I think we all do that just because we love this research and innovation side of things so much. And I think it's also extremely important because that's the only way to advance clinical side of things too. So yeah, there isn't any magic formula to balance it all. But Arshi, did you want to add anything to this?
I think that's really well put, Sabha. The only thing I would like to add to that is that since I'm more towards the statistical side of things, we have to also build like very robust models. And there is this always thin line where we have to convey our results in the most applicable manner, where they are not over interpreted, or something that will still hold true if the data kind of slightly changes.
You know, Arshi, you bring up a really strong point here. I think if on the computational side of things, bioinformatics, which is like a subfield of computational biology in a way, I think we still have a ways to go. Many bioinformaticians who write software, which we all use, don't always come with software engineering background. So the code is not necessarily optimized. And many cases, it's not maintained. I'm guilty of that too in some cases. Now, not every bioinformatics team is like that, but this is the general reality of things. I think definitely now it's time for bioinformatics teams to invest in computer science and engineering majors who can bring a professional level of skills to software packages. I know that large institutes are already doing this, but I think all groups need to start investing in this.
Yeah, I agree, Sabha. And I think the another big thing with research is that everything is open sourced. So it's not a black box. We kind of go and we can see the code and it's freely available. And there's always this free flow of communications where we can always ask the author of the manuscript about more questions. And that just leads to more collaborative avenues.
Absolutely. There are so many great repositories in GitHub where a lot of users have contributed code too, right?
Yeah. And I think that's just the best way to do it. And then the more the package is used, I know there's this big responsibility of maintaining it. And if it's really getting used by a lot of users, then I think that is automatically built in where you know where it's failing and how it's doing.
So Arshi, for our young scientist listeners, what according to you are good practices to be up to date in the field even after you graduate?
My advice might not be very comprehensive because I'm still learning. But one thing I would like to add, what really helped me is that there's a lot of self-teaching involved, whether it is reading a lot of papers. And it's really difficult to find that time to read papers, as you said, that you can't balance those
things. Absolutely.
Exactly. Once you get into the rhythm of reading papers, it's easy to maintain. When they say when you have to run a marathon, you have to start with running a mile, like 1 mile. Similarly, with reading papers, you just have to start with one. There are a lot of ways where we can keep in touch with our field or know something new, and that is by going to different conferences. And there's just so much research in conferences. You know, there are poster presentations, there are keynote speakers, and there are people who are presenting their work. So that's actually a very synthesized way to get a lot of information and meet your colleagues in one place.
I think that even after your disclaimer on not being comprehensive, you gave the best advice that even I could have given.
I try to be modest.
You know, I love conferences. I always find them to be very motivating, and I always come back with so many ideas in my head afterwards. Everyone should have at least this one conference that they go to every year.
I agree. Now, moving away from all this advice and motivational stuff, obviously, our journey hasn't been all that smooth. There's been some ups and downs, and of course, some goof-ups. So I thought we will end this episode by sharing an embarrassing moment in our professional life.
Oh my God, Arshi, why would you do this to us?
Since we're sharing.
Because this is your idea, I think you should go first while I think about mine.
Okay, I think I have one. So when I started as a statistician at MSK, showing summary tables was quite routine. By summary table, I mean you have a couple of clinical variables and you just summarize them. So this one time I was showing this summarizing table with some clinical variables and counts. So my headings were essentially variable and counts observed. And I had 5 or 6 such tables. And in all the spelling of counts observed, I forgot the O in counts.
Oh my God, you did not.
I know. I was really embarrassed. And when, as I'm showing my results, I realize, oh, there's a typo there.
Oh my God. I cannot imagine what went through your head. I can imagine your face though.
I was red in my face.
Okay. I think I have one. I can't think of anything where something happened in front of a person. I'm sure it did, and I've just blocked it out of my head.
Very healthy.
Yep. This was recently in one of our episodes. I was recording it and I was like, you know, I just want to check this pronunciation of this word. Something might be off. And I checked it and I realized that there was this word that I'd been pronouncing wrong all my life. And wrong doesn't mean that, oh, I have a British pronunciation for an instead of an American pronunciation. Wrong as in no English pronunciation has that. So, the word was development, and I'm sure I'm going to mess it up just because I've been saying it wrong all my life. Well, the reason it's embarrassing is not because of just the fact that I've been saying it wrong. It's because my PhD was in the field of developmental biology.
Oh my God.
So for the last 14 years, I've been saying this word wrong.
It's never too late.
Well, now the whole world knows, so that's okay. I'm assuming the whole world listens to our podcast. Well, on that embarrassing note, listeners, that brings us to the end of our episode. I had so much fun recording this, and I definitely found it very therapeutic to talk about things that maybe I've not actually talked about before. And Arshi, there are things that you and I haven't talked about with each other either.
That is true, you know. We run at such an insane pace every day of our in our lives. And I can literally say that being in New York.
Oh, yes, that's true for you, you know. It's true, you know, every day we feel like there are these blinders on. We're focusing on whatever our immediate priorities are. I don't think we'd actually take back and think about our journeys the way computationally yours is kind of forcing you and me to do. I really love it.
I agree. And as you said, I found this episode quite therapeutic too.
So listeners, we hope that this episode helped you to learn a little bit about us, or at least just laugh with us a little bit. Do subscribe to us and follow us on social media. Our details are in the description below.
And until next time, this is Computationally Yours.